kaisernetwork.org.
Dr. Judy Auerbach, Vice President for Public Policy and Program Development for the American Foundation for AIDS Research. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Now,
this conference is geared mostly towards research, but there's been a common theme here in Rio about bringing the scientific community and the community of people living with HIV and AIDS together to help them understand each other better. What are your thoughts on that?
A number of things. First of all, there are a number of scientists who are HIV positive, and we tend to forget that that may be the case. And so I think it's a false dichotomy to pose the community as different from scientists and scientists as different from community. Most of the scientists who are involved in HIV and AIDS research are very committed people. They're dealing with research in an area that they care very strongly about. So I think that they're not far from the community most of the time. The problem in part is that when you speak technically, in technical language, as these scientific conferences really require, then it's very hard for community people who are not trained in science to necessarily understand some of what's being conveyed. At the same time, a lot of scientists work in their little labs and, you know, are dealing with very small units, whether it's a cell or a molecule or a gene, and they often do forget the whole person and the whole environment. And so I actually think these conferences are really important as a way to bring communities together of scientists and activists, policymakers, positive people, negative people, to have these kind of dialogues and learn how to talk to each other in understandable and respectful ways.
Now, your organization, AMFAR, sponsored a satellite session about gender-based violence in HIV. Can you talk about the research that was presented at that session and why you decided to sponsor that session?
Certainly. And in fact, it's not unconnected to the question you just asked, because what we've been very interested in what is happening with women in the HIV and AIDS epidemic globally. And the symposium we hosted last night was part of a larger initiative we have on women's sexual health and HIV. And one of the key factors that's fueling the epidemic amongst women, and particularly young women, is violence, and specifically sexual violence. And it occurred to us that people are vaguely aware, in a general sense, of the contribution of violence to susceptibility or vulnerability to infection among women, but there's actually a lot of science that just hasn't been well presented in a large venue like this, where you have a very diverse group of people. So our intention was to say, what do we know about from the basic biological through clinical, behavioral, and social research that could inform our understanding of how and why violence contributes, sexual violence in particular, contributes to the increased vulnerability of women, and particularly young women, to HIV infection, and what happens after infection in the sense that violence can sometimes be a consequence. So we were looking at what we know from a range of scientific disciplines, as well as lived experience, that will tell us about how violence operates as both a cause, if you will, or a factor, and a consequence of HIV infection. So we had speakers who, in the first case, presented some of the basic biological and physiological data about why women are more susceptible to infection, specifically through heterosexual intercourse that has to do with vulnerabilities of the female genital tract, exacerbated for younger women because they're less developed, through some of the clinical issues. We had a woman from Rwanda talking about a cohort that's been established to study infection amongst women who were victims of rape, as well as the genocide in Rwanda, and they're looking at treatment and psychological issues attendant with those women's experience as well. And then we wanted to talk about gender-based violence, sexual violence as part of gender-based violence, a larger category that affects women everywhere and also has a lot to do with HIV. So we had a woman from the United States, a behavioral scientist, who could talk about some work she's been doing in particularly low-income communities, urban communities in America, to in part make the point as well with these range of speakers that this is something that happens all over the world to women of all classes and educational levels, and that we have to look from at this in a very multidisciplinary way to really understand the phenomenon.
Now, in his opening ceremony speech, Stephen Lewis, who's the UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa, said that the failure to intervene on behalf of women is, quote, the single greatest international failure, end quote, of the fight against HIV and AIDS. Would you agree with that?
I probably would agree with that. It's been a very interesting development. There's a lot of talk, certainly a lot of chatter about women in the epidemic. And last year, women and AIDS was the theme of the international AIDS, what do we call it, World AIDS Day. But there's still a sort of resistance, I think, to dealing with women, which one can argue is just a reflection of gender inequities that exist in all ways in all societies. But what's particularly striking, and I think he was referring to, is the increasingly disparate impact of the epidemic on women and girls, so that it's not just that women and men are both getting infected, but we're seeing the increases among women rising really precipitously, and particularly young women. You have young women, 15 to 24-year-old, in a number of countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, who are at, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6 times more likely to be infected than young men. So you have to ask the question about why this is and what we should be doing about it. The why gets to these kind of different multidisciplinary analyses. We tried to present some of last night in the context of violence, but the biological, the behavioral, and the social. When you really start dealing with the social, though, you realize that it's about gender inequities. They're manifest in different ways in different cultures. And what was somewhat concluded at our symposium and other sessions I went to today, what Stephen Lewis is referring to, has to do with really grappling with some very fundamental ways in which women and men are treated differently in all societies. It's institutionalized in laws and policies and structures and religion, all our social institutions. And to get at the HIV infection risk and the impact, we have to actually deal with these larger issues. So I think he was making a very important point, and he was also challenging us to realize that we can't just deal with HIV infection either, and we can't just look at it as a virus that happens maybe differently in some ways between women and men. But we're going to have to contend with really address educational inequities, economic inequities that make women socially more vulnerable through their dependence on men or their unequal treatment under the law, their lack of resources. So it was a challenging statement. He said that no organization, I guess, had dedicated themselves. We are not entirely dedicated to women and AIDS, but AMFAR has, we think, stepped to the plate by having this initiative and the symposium we had last night as part of it.
Now, one scientific development that's been largely talked about to help women is microbicides. So can you talk a little bit about where we are in microbicide research and where you see the future?
Right. So the idea about microbicides, vaginal microbicides or rectal microbicides, really, is to provide some kind of new technology that women can use, they can initiate, as the way folks are talking about them these days, that doesn't require necessarily the cooperation of a male partner, the knowledge of a male partner, and that could provide protection from infection through sexual intercourse for women. It's been very slow to get off the ground. A lot of people will argue who've been in this advocacy or scientific arena in microbicides for years. And there we're back to what you were asking earlier. Some of it just has to do with the fact that it was about women. But the field has really grown quickly in recent years. So there are a number of products that are already in phase 3 trials. That means human trials for effectiveness or efficacy. And there's a lot of promise. Some people think we'll see a microbicide before we'll see a vaccine. I think what's important to say is microbicides and other technologies are part of the solution, but any microbicide, as well as a vaccine, is going to be partially effective. It's not going to be 100% effective in preventing transmission. So I think even the microbicides scientists would say we have to at the same time address these gender inequities and the social situation of women so that they can use the microbicide in the first place safely and effectively, but also so that we provide an environment in which they're less likely to face infection.
Now, there was a presentation today on male circumcision saying that one particular study, it was the first randomized control trial, said that male circumcision offered a 70% protection rate of contracting HIV from a female partner, but still many people are saying that we should be cautious about these results. Mm-hmm. What is your reaction to these findings?
Well, it's really quite striking because it's a very high level of efficacy or protection, and I think that's surprised people. I don't think they expected to see something on the order of 70%. It's the first randomized controlled trial, as you mentioned, so I think scientists would caution and say we need to continue to do, there are actually 2 or 3 other trials in process, and I think we would all like to await the findings from those studies to see if this kind of level of protection holds up. It obviously, the protection was in one direction. That's what was being assessed. So it's male acquisition of infection from a positive woman. One of the trials is going to see whether women are also protected by a man being circumcised. That's going to be very important for us to learn. So firstly, we need to do these other studies and see if these findings are validated. Then the thorny issue, of course, is if this is shown to be as effective it is, or protective as it appears to be, what do we do as a society? How do you implement this intervention? What might happen if the intervention... One of the things that researchers are very keen to caution about is that the circumcision in the trial happened in a very controlled, medically safe, sterile environment. Because it's also a cultural practice, it's very likely that in many instances there are going to be circumcision shacks set up somewhere on the roadside. People are afraid that that might happen if the word, if it gets, the scientific findings get translated in some lay way that sound like just go get circumcised. So you have to worry about the conditions under which the technological intervention happens. There's some concerns about men having sex before they're healed, and actually if they've got, you know, openings or wounds or whatever, they actually could be more susceptible to infection themselves. And there's some concern about what everybody calls behavioral disinhibition, which applies to all these technologies, that if you think you're protected, are you going to now not use condoms, when in fact you're still not 100% protected. You still have to use condoms or engage in other prevention behaviors. So there's a great deal of concern that if men get the idea that they're going to be protected from acquiring infection through circumcision, they no longer have to worry about using condoms or reducing their number of sex partners and so on. So all of these are still very open questions that I think, but the community of scientists, clinicians, and policymakers are really starting to talk about it and think about it already.
So speaking more generally just about scientific advances, what do you feel like is necessary to take scientific advances and actually move them into the field for real-world results?
Oh, a lot. It depends on the nature of the scientific advance. Some technological advances are much easier to implement than, say, social or behavioral interventions that require a lot of mobilizing people and, you know, more human infrastructure. There, too, I think there are a lot of false distinction. A lot of intervention studies, they're research studies, but they're actually already involving people in prevention education or, you know, clinical care. So you're actually doing some intervention work while you're testing an intervention. You're already implementing some things, and we tend to undercount that or not really credit that some implementation, in a sense, is already happening, or some intervention is already happening. One of the things we really need and we don't have enough of are people who can make the translation from science to practice. So you can, you know, the scientists develop interventions or they test interventions or they do basic science, of course, but they're not necessarily the people who can or should take the finding and then put it to practice. So you need translators. It's part of our mission as an organization. And AMFAR engages in that kind of translation through all kinds of means, whether it's medical education or lay education. Conferences are a good way to make that kind of exchange occur as well. But I think we need more people, community people who are educated about science, to go back to your initial question when I resisted this dichotomy, but a lot of the AIDS activists are really a fabulous example of people who sort of self-educated about very basic science kinds of questions. We need more of that, particularly around women. And we need scientists who can learn better how to translate their very technical language to lay language and actually go interact in venues that they don't necessarily do on a regular basis.
Dr. Judy Auerbach, Vice President for Public Policy and Program Development for the American Foundation for AIDS Research. Thanks again for your time today.
You're quite welcome.